Welcome to Thinking Aloud. This is the latest in our series of podcasts for the Warwick History Department's Early Modern Forum. My name is Tim Davis, I'm a PhD student in the History Department, and I'm here with Professor Richard Watmore from the University of Sussex. Thank you for doing this, Richard, for us today.
It's a pleasure.
Can I start by asking you about your favourite primary source?
My favourite primary source is a manuscript that can be found in Geneva, and it can be found in what's now called the Bibliothèque de Genève in the manuscripts department, which is called the Salle Senebier. And it's an important document because it's a description of the defences of Geneva. In other words, it's a description of the fortifications. It's dated 1719, and the reason that it is important is twofold. The first reason is because at that time, in the early part of the 18th century, the Genevans are very concerned that their walls are no longer going to be able to be sufficient to withstand siege, and therefore there's an extensive internal debate which results in the appointment of 18th century management consultants to tell the state who they ought to employ, well, whether, first of all, and then who they ought to employ to rebuild and restore the city walls. And a document is prepared describing the fortifications, and plans are drawn up, and a famous artilleryman is appointed to undertake the works. And the document that I'm most interested in, it concerns a man called Michele Ducray. And Michele Ducray, like many Genevans, went abroad to serve in the armed forces of Europe's monarchies. So he's a captain in a French regiment, has profound interest in artillery and also in sieges, and he writes a critique of the Genevan plans, because he's a citizen at Geneva. That means obviously he's involved at the General Council and he's able to discuss the fortification issue. It's all kept very under wraps because the Genevans are very concerned, as anybody would be in terms of fortifications, that foreign powers will get hold of the document. And we now come to the second reason why I think that this particular primary source is as important as it is. And that is because a young man called Jean-Jacques Rousseau, his uncle was a citizen at Geneva, a man called Bernard, and he somehow got a copy of Michele's critique of the fortifications. The fortifications were then put into practice, and Michele's document became notorious, and the Genevans try and get all of the copies and burn it, because they think that it will help people to invade or carry out a successful siege should a crisis arise. Now, Rousseau, as you may know, leaves Geneva and embraces Catholicism when he's a teenager, and he then ends up being employed by the state that is one of the main enemies of Geneva, Savoy. And in his confessions, Rousseau, one of his major confessions is that he gives the document that he found amongst his uncle's possessions to the Savoyard authorities. Therefore, Rousseau committed treason, effectively, against the city, which obviously he proclaimed on all of his work, citizen of Geneva. He betrayed the city when he was relatively young. We don't know what the Savoyard did with the document. Perhaps they already had a copy. But it's an interesting case of a major Enlightenment figure doing something very naughty. And it reveals an awful lot about the concerns of states like Geneva, who put an enormous amount of resources into building walls around the city and maintaining the walls and making sure they can withstand the kinds of siege that had become famous during the time of Louis XIV. And And obviously documents like that were very, very important, and consequently it's a very important one, and it's part of a cache of documents concerning the fortification of Geneva that you can find in the Bibliothèque de Genève.
Fantastic, very interesting stuff. I wondered if you could say a little bit about how you've used that in your own work.
I haven't really used it, I have to say. I've just been fascinated by it because it's part of an interesting story. I have done a little bit of work on Michele Ducret, because Michele Ducret is a bit of a character, because he is very interested in natural philosophy. He's an instrument maker, he's a cartographer, but he's also a political radical, and he believes that the Genevans, in refusing to accept his criticism of their fortification policy, he thinks that it's an aristocratic conspiracy against him in particular, and he thinks that it's corrupt because the people who are building the new walls are effectively too close to the magistrates, and actually they're not doing any good because they should realise that his critique is the right one. He ends up being censored and exiled from Geneva, and he becomes one of the... He inspires a series of popular rebellions against the ruling magistrates in the 1730s. So he was one of those philosophic, awkward cusses who turn up so often in the 18th century, and it's this, the document about the fortifications is only one of a number of his concerned with how Geneva ought to be run and the government of Geneva, and the only thing that I have actually done about him is he writes a manuscript, a series of letters in 1735, which is letters on the government of Geneva, 10 letters saying how to reform the state and how it should be organised, and he... it circulates in manuscript, and I and several other people produced an edition of this work. But the fortifications, the material on fortifications, really remains there for somebody to work on in future.
If I could now move on to ask you about your favourite secondary source.
Favourite secondary source is going to be probably much less interesting, and it's infinitely more dense as a book, and that is J.G.A. Pocock's The Machiavellian Moment, which I think many intellectual historians would choose simply because it is the most influential work by an intellectual historian probably since people started calling themselves intellectual historians over the past 30 or 40 years. Obviously, it's published in 1975 by Princeton. It was reissued 2002-2003 with an afterword. And it's really the book that, if you want to work in intellectual history in early modern, or really any aspect of intellectual history, but obviously, although Pocock is interested in the ancient modern debate, and the work really runs from Aristotle to the consequences of republicanism for North America through the 19th century. The focus is early modern. It's really the 17th century England and through the 18th century, as everybody will know who knows his essays, either the collection, you know, Virtue, Commerce, and History, etc. And it's important because it, I think, above all works of intellectual history, it's interesting to the broader community of historians because it shows that the ideas that define a world can reveal so much about the structures of power and the relationships between parties. In other words, all of your classic historical categories, I think Pocock managed to illuminate everything through his intellectual history research. It's not the case these days that people would necessarily think that his method and the same goes for Quentin Skinner's work, that their own work necessarily exemplifies their historiographical method or the philosophy of history that they have espoused in different essays. It's simply a fantastically imaginative work of historical scholarship that that if you can cope with it, and I first read it as an undergraduate and thought that I understood bits and pieces, and at the time I was being supervised by Brendan Bradshaw, who was a great Tudor historian, and writing about Pocock, some of Pocock's distinctions, and then trying to use them to explain Tudor and Stuart government to Brendan Bradshaw, he replied to me that I hadn't understood anything at all, and I think that is a normal response to reading Pocock for the first time, because it is a notoriously dense and challenging tome, but it's always one that you can go back to and get an awful lot out of, because the historical imagination is so vast. And that's why it, I suppose you would say, it is the equivalent of, I don't know, E.P. Thompson's Made in the English Working Class for intellectual historians. Obviously an alternative text would be Quentin Skinner's Foundations of Modern Political Thought, but I think Pocock's is the one for me, simply because of the way that he explains the evolution of early modern political thought, and ties together politics and political economy and natural philosophy and international relations. It's as if he doesn't believe in or doesn't accept that you can apply later academic divisions of labour to early modern times, and because he rejects the modern academic division of labour and tries to reconstruct their world, which obviously didn't adopt our categories, it's all the more illuminating for that.
Okay, a very good choice, I think. Thank you for your time, Richard, and thank you for talking to us about your favourite primary and secondary sources.
Thank you very much.